Chapter 1. A terrible loss. There could be no doubt of the fact, Princess Ozma, the lovely girl ruler of the fairyland of Oz, was lost. She had completely disappeared. Not one of her subjects, not even her closest friends, knew what had become of her. It was Dorothy who first discovered it. Dorothy was a little Kansas girl who had come to the land of Oz to live and had been given a delightful suite of rooms in Ozma's royal palace just because Ozma loved Dorothy and wanted her to live as near her as possible so the two girls might be much together. Dorothy was not the only girl from the outside world who had been welcomed to Oz and lived in the royal palace. There was another named Betsy Bobbin, whose adventures had led her to seek refuge with Ozma, and still another named Trot, who had been invited, together with her faithful companion Cap'n Bill, to make her home in this wonderful fairyland. The three girls all had rooms in the palace and were great chums, but Dorothy was the dearest friend of their gracious ruler, and only she at any hour dared to seek Ozma in her royal apartments. For Dorothy had lived in Oz much longer than the other girls and had been made a princess of the realm. Betsy was a year older than Dorothy and Trot was a year younger, yet the three were near enough of an age to become great playmates and to have nice times together. It was while the three were talking together one morning in Dorothy's room that Betsy proposed they make a journey into the Munchkin Country, which was one of the four great countries of the Land of Oz ruled by Ozma. "I've never been there yet," said Betsy Bobbin, "but the Scarecrow once told me it is the prettiest country in all Oz." "I'd like to go, too," added Trot. "All right," said Dorothy. "I'll go and ask Ozma. Perhaps she will let us take the Sawhorse and the Red Wagon, which would be much nicer for us than having to walk all the way. This Land of Oz is a pretty big place when you get to all the edges of it." So she jumped up and went along the halls of the splendid palace until she came to the royal suite, which filled all the front of the second floor. In a little waiting room sat Ozma's maid, Jellia Jam, who was busily sewing.
"Is Ozma up yet?" inquired Dorothy.
"I don't know, my dear," replied Jellia. "I haven't heard a word from her this morning. She hasn't even called for her bath or her breakfast, and it is far past her usual time for them."
"That's strange," exclaimed the little girl.
"Yes," agreed the maid, "but of course no harm could have happened to her. No one can die or be killed in the Land of Oz, and Ozma is herself a powerful fairy, and she has no enemies so far as we know. Therefore I am not at all worried about her, though I must admit her silence is unusual."
"Perhaps," said Dorothy thoughtfully, "she is overslept. Or she may be reading or working out some new sort of magic to do good to her people."
"Any of these things may be true," replied Jellia Jam, "so I haven't dared disturb our royal mistress. You, however, are a privileged character, princess, and I am sure that Ozma wouldn't mind at all if you went in to see her."
"Of course not," said Dorothy, and opening the door of the outer chamber, she went in. All was still here. She walked into another room, which was Ozma's boudoir, and then, pushing back a heavy drapery richly broidered with threads of pure gold, the girl entered the sleeping room of the fairy ruler of Oz. The bed of ivory and gold was vacant, the room was vacant, not a trace of Ozma was to be found. Very much surprised, yet still with no fear that anything had happened to her friend, Dorothy returned through the boudoir to the other rooms of the suite. She went into the music room, the library, the laboratory, the bath, the wardrobe, and even into the great throne room, which adjoined the royal suite, but in none of these places could she find Ozma. So she returned to the anteroom where she had left the maid, Jellia Jam, and said,
"She isn't in her rooms now, so she must have gone out."
"I don't understand how she could do that without my seeing her," replied Jellia, "unless she made herself invisible."
"She isn't there, anyhow," declared Dorothy.
"Then let us go find her," suggested the maid, who appeared to be a little uneasy. So they went into the corridors, and there Dorothy almost stumbled over a queer girl who was dancing lightly along the passage.
"Stop a minute, Scraps," she called. "Have you seen Ozma this morning?"
"Not I," replied the queer girl, dancing nearer. "I lost both my eyes in a tussle with the Woozy last night, for the creature scraped them both off my face with his square paws. So I put the eyes in my pocket, and this morning Button Bright led me to Aunt Em, who sewed them on again. So I've seen nothing at all today, except during the last 5 minutes. So of course I haven't seen Ozma."
"Very well, Scraps," said Dorothy, looking curiously at the eyes, which were merely two round, black buttons sewed upon the girl's face. There were other things about Scraps that would have seemed curious to one seeing her for the first time. She was commonly called the Patchwork Girl because her body and limbs were made from a gay-colored patchwork quilt which had been cut into shape and stuffed with cotton. Her head was a round ball stuffed in the same manner and fastened to her shoulders. For hair,
She had a mass of brown yarn, and to make a nose for her, a part of the cloth had been pulled out into the shape of a knob and tied with a string to hold it in place. Her mouth had been carefully made by cutting a slit in the proper place and lining it with red silk, adding two rows of pearls for teeth and a bit of red flannel for a tongue. In spite of this queer makeup, the patchwork girl was magically alive and had proved herself not the least jolly and agreeable of the many quaint characters who inhabit the astonishing fairyland of Oz. Indeed, Scraps was a general favorite, although she was rather flighty and erratic and did and said many things that surprised her friends. She was seldom still, but loved to dance, to turn handsprings and somersaults, to climb trees and to indulge in many other active sports. "I'm going to search for Ozma," remarked Dorothy, "for she isn't in her rooms, and I want to ask her a question." "I'll go with you," said Scraps, "for my eyes are brighter than yours, and they can see farther."
"I'm not sure of that," returned Dorothy. "But come along, if you like." Together they searched all through the great palace and even to the farthest limits of the palace grounds, which were quite extensive, but nowhere could they find a trace of Ozma. When Dorothy returned to where Betsy and Trot awaited her, the little girl's face was rather solemn and troubled, for never before had Ozma gone away without telling her friends where she was going, or without an escort that befitted her royal state. She was gone, however, and none had seen her go. Dorothy had met and questioned the Scarecrow, Tick-Tock, the Shaggy Man, Button Bright, Cap'n Bill, and even the wise and powerful Wizard of Oz, but not one of them had seen Ozma since she parted with her friends the evening before and had gone to her own rooms. "She didn't say anything last night about going anywhere," observed Little Trot.
"No, and that's the strange part of it," replied Dorothy. "Usually Ozma lets us know of everything she does."
"Why not look in the magic picture?" suggested Betsy Bobbin. "That will tell us where she is in just one second."
"Of course," cried Dorothy. "Why didn't I think of that before?" And at once the three girls hurried away to Ozma's boudoir, where the magic picture always hung. This wonderful magic picture was one of the royal Ozma's greatest treasures. There was a large gold frame in the center of which was a bluish-gray canvas on which various scenes constantly appeared and disappeared. If one who stood before it wished to see what any person anywhere in the world was doing, it was only necessary to make the wish and the scene in the magic picture would shift to the scene where that person was and show exactly what he or she was then engaged in doing. So the girls knew it would be easy for them to wish to see Ozma, and from the picture they could quickly learn where she was. Dorothy advanced to the place where the picture was usually protected by thick satin curtains and pulled the draperies aside. Then she stared in amazement, while her two friends uttered exclamations of disappointment. The magic picture was gone. Only a blank space on the wall behind the curtain showed where it had formerly hung. Chapter 2. The Troubles of Glinda the Good. That same morning there was great excitement in the castle of the powerful sorceress of Oz, Glinda the Good. This castle, situated in the Quadling country, far south of the Emerald City where Ozma ruled, was a splendid structure of exquisite marbles and silver grills. Here the sorceress lived, surrounded by a bevy of the most beautiful maidens of Oz, gathered from all the four countries of that fairyland as well as from the magnificent Emerald City itself, which stood in the place where the four countries cornered. It was considered a great honor to be allowed to serve the good sorceress, whose arts of magic were used only to benefit the Oz people. Glinda was Ozma's most valued servant, for her knowledge of sorcery was wonderful, and she could accomplish almost anything that her mistress, the lovely girl ruler of Oz, wished her to. Of all the magical things which surrounded Glinda in her castle, there was none more marvelous than her great book of records. On the pages of this record book were constantly being inscribed, day by day and hour by hour, all the important events that happened anywhere in the known world, and they were inscribed in the book at exactly the moment the events happened. Every adventure in the land of Oz and in the big outside world, and even in places that you and I have never heard of, were recorded accurately in the great book, which never made a mistake and stated only the exact truth. For that reason, nothing could be concealed from Glinda the Good, who had only to look at the pages of the great book of records to know everything that had taken place. That was one reason she was such a great sorceress, for the records made her wiser than any other living person. This wonderful book was placed upon a big gold table that stood in the middle of Glinda's drawing room. The legs of the table, which were encrusted with precious gems, were firmly fastened to the tiled floor, and the book itself was chained to the table and locked with six stout golden padlocks, the keys to which Glinda carried on a chain that was secured around her own neck. The pages of the great book were larger in size than those of an American newspaper, and although they were exceedingly thin, there were so many of them that they made an enormous, bulky volume. With its gold cover and gold clasps, the book was so heavy that three men could scarcely have lifted it.
Yet this morning when Glinda entered her drawing room after breakfast, the good sorceress was amazed to discover that her great book of records had mysteriously disappeared. Advancing to the table, she found the chains had been cut with some sharp instrument, and this must have been done while all in the castle slept. Glinda was shocked and grieved. Who could have done this wicked, bold thing? And who could wish to deprive her of her great book of records? The sorceress was thoughtful for a time, considering the consequences of her loss. Then she went to her room of magic to prepare a charm that would tell her who had stolen the record book. But when she unlocked her cupboard and threw open the doors, all of her magical instruments and rare chemical compounds had been removed from the shelves. The sorceress was now both angry and alarmed. She sat down in a chair and tried to think how this extraordinary robbery could have taken place. It was evident that the thief was some person of very great power, or the theft could not have been accomplished without her knowledge. But who, in all the land of Oz, was powerful and skillful enough to do this awful thing? And who, having the power, could also have an object in defying the wisest and most talented sorceress the world has ever known? Glinda thought over the perplexing matter for a full hour, at the end of which time she was still puzzled how to explain it. But although her instruments and chemicals were gone, her knowledge of magic had not been stolen, by any means, since no thief, however skillful, can rob one of knowledge, and that is why knowledge is the best and safest treasure to acquire. Glinda believed that when she had time to gather more magical herbs and elixirs and to manufacture more magical instruments, she would be able to discover who the robber was and what had become of her precious book of records. "Whoever has done this," she said to her maidens, "is a very foolish person, for in time he is sure to be found out and will then be severely punished." She now made a list of the things she needed and dispatched messengers to every part of Oz with instructions to obtain them and bring them to her as soon as possible. And one of her messengers met the little Wizard of Oz, who was seated on the back of the famous Liv Sawhorse and was clinging to its neck with both his arms, for the sawhorse was speeding to Glinda's castle with the velocity of the wind, bearing the news that Royal Ozma, ruler of all the great land of Oz, had suddenly disappeared and no one in the Emerald City knew what had become of her. "Also," said the wizard as he stood before the astonished sorceress, "Ozma's magic picture is gone, so we cannot consult it to discover where she is. So I came to you for assistance as soon as we realized our loss. Let us look in the great book of records." "Alas," returned the sorceress sorrowfully, "we cannot do that, for the great book of records has also disappeared." Chapter 3. The Robbery of Cake the Cookie Cook. One more important theft was reported in the Land of Oz that eventful morning, but it took place so far from either the Emerald City or the castle of Glinda the Good that none of those persons we have mentioned learned of the robbery until long afterward. In the far southwestern corner of the Winkie Country is a broad tableland that can be reached only by climbing a steep hill, whichever side one approaches it. On the hillside surrounding this tableland are no paths at all, but there are quantities of bramble bushes with sharp prickers on them, which prevent any of the Oz people who live down below from climbing up to see what is on top. But on top live the Yips, and although the space they occupy is not great in extent, the Wee Country is all their own. The Yips had never up to the time this story begins left their broad tableland to go down into the Land of Oz, nor had the Oz people ever climbed up to the country of the Yips. Living all alone as they did, the Yips had queer ways and notions of their own and did not resemble any other people of the Land of Oz. Their houses were scattered all over the flat surface, not like a city, grouped together, but set wherever their owner's fancy dictated, with fields here, trees there, and odd little paths connecting the houses one with another. It was here, on the morning when Ozma so strangely disappeared from the Emerald City, that Cake the Cookie Cook discovered that her diamond-studded gold dishpan had been stolen, and she raised such a hue and cry over her loss and wailed and shrieked so loudly that many of the Yips gathered around her house to inquire what was the matter. It was a serious thing in any part of the Land of Oz to accuse one of stealing, so when the Yips heard Cake the Cookie Cook declare that her jewel dishpan had been stolen, they were both humiliated and disturbed and forced Cake to go with them to the Frogmen to see what could be done about it. I do not suppose you have ever before heard of the Frogmen, for like all other dwellers on that tableland, he had never been away from it, nor had anyone come up there to see him. The Frogman was in truth descended from the common frogs of Oz, and when he was first born he lived in a pool in the Winkie Country and was much like any other frog. Being of an adventurous nature, however, he soon hopped out of his pool and began to travel, when a big bird came along and seized him in its beak and started to fly away with him to its nest. When high in the air, the frog wriggled so frantically that he got loose and fell down, down, down into a small hidden pool on the tableland of the Yips. Now that pool, it seems, was unknown to the Yips because it was surrounded by thick bushes and was not near to any dwelling, and it proved to be an enchanted pool, for the frog grew very fast and very big, feeding on the magic skosh which is found nowhere else on earth except in that one pool. And the skosh not only made the frog very big so that when he stood on his hind legs he was as tall as any yip in the country, but it made him unusually intelligent, so that he soon knew more than the yips did and was able to reason and to argue very well indeed. No one could expect a frog with these talents to remain in a hidden pool, so he finally got out of it and mingled with the people of the tableland, who were amazed at his appearance and greatly impressed by his learning. They had never seen a frog before, and the frog had never seen a yip before, but as there were plenty of yips and only one frog, the frog became the most important. He did not hop anymore, but stood upright on his hind legs and dressed himself in fine clothes and sat in chairs and did all the things that people do, so he soon came to be called the Frogman, and that is the only name he has ever had. After some years had passed, the people came to regard the Frogman as their advisor in all matters that puzzled them. They brought all their difficulties to him, and when he did not know anything, he pretended to know it, which seemed to answer just as well. Indeed, the yips thought the Frogman was much wiser than he really was, and he allowed them to think so, being very proud of his position of authority. There was another pool on the tableland which was not enchanted but contained good, clear water and was located close to the dwellings. Here the people built the Frogman a house of his own, close to the edge of the pool so that he could take a bath or a swim whenever he wished. He usually swam in the pool in the early morning before anyone else was up, and during the day he dressed himself in his beautiful clothes and sat in his house and received the visits of all the yips who came to him to ask his advice. The Frogman's usual costume consisted of knee breeches made of yellow satin plush, with trimmings of gold braid and jeweled knee buckles, a white satin vest with silver buttons in which were set solitaire rubies, a swallow-tailed coat of bright yellow, green stockings and red leather shoes turned up at the toes and having diamond buckles. He wore, when he walked out, a purple silk hat and carried a gold-headed cane. Over his eyes he wore great spectacles with gold rims, not because his eyes were bad, but because the spectacles made him look wise, and so distinguished and gorgeous was his appearance that all the yips were very proud of him. There was no king or queen in the yip country, so the simple inhabitants naturally came to look upon the frogman as their leader as well as their counselor in all times of emergency. In his heart the big frog knew he was no wiser than the yips, but for a frog to know as much as a person was quite remarkable, and the frogman was shrewd enough to make the people believe he was far more wise than he really was. They never suspected he was a humbug, but listened to his words with great respect and did just what he advised them to do. Now when Kate the cookie cook raised such an outcry over the theft of her diamond-studded dishpan, the first thought of the people was to take her to the frogman and inform him of the loss, thinking that of course he would tell her where to find it. He listened to the story with his big eyes wide open behind his spectacles, and said in his deep, croaking voice, "If the dishpan is stolen, somebody must have taken it." "But who?" asked Cake anxiously. "Who is the thief?" "The one who took the dishpan, of course," replied the frogman, and hearing this all the yips nodded their heads gravely and said to one another, "It is absolutely true." "But I want my dishpan," cried Cake. "No one can blame you for that wish," remarked the frogman. "Then tell me where I may find it," she urged. The look the frogman gave her was a very wise look, and he rose from his chair and strutted up and down the room with his hands under his coattails in a very pompous and imposing manner. This was the first time so difficult a matter had been brought to him, and he wanted time to think. It would never do to let them suspect his ignorance, and so he thought very, very hard how best to answer the woman without betraying himself. "I beg to inform you," said he, "that nothing in the Yip country has ever been stolen before." "We know that already," answered Cake the cookie cook impatiently. "Therefore," continued the frogman, "this theft becomes a very important matter." "Well, where is my dishpan?" demanded the woman. "It is lost, but it must be found. Unfortunately, we have no policemen or detectives to unravel the mystery, so we must employ other means to regain the lost article. Cake must first write a proclamation and tack it to the door of her house, and the proclamation must read that whoever stole the jewel dishpan must return it at once." "But suppose no one returns it," suggested Cake. "Then," said the frogman, "that very fact will be proof that no one has stolen it." Cake was not satisfied, but the other yips seemed to approve the plan highly. They all advised her to do as the frogman had told her to, so she posted the sign on her door and waited patiently for someone to return the dishpan, which no one ever did. Again she went, accompanied by a group of her neighbors, to the frogman, who by this time had given the matter considerable thought. Said he to Cake, "I am now convinced that no yip has taken your dishpan, and since it is gone from the yip country, I suspect that some stranger came from the world down below us in the darkness of night when all of us were asleep and took away your treasure. There can be no other explanation of its disappearance. So if you wish to recover that golden, diamond-studded dishpan, you must go into the lower world after it." This was indeed a startling proposition. Cake and her friends went to the edge of the flat tableland and looked down the steep hillside to the plains below. It was so far to the bottom of the hill that nothing there could be seen very distinctly, and it seemed to the Yips very venturesome, if not dangerous, to go so far from home into an unknown land. However, Cake wanted her dishpan very badly, so she turned to her friends and asked, "Who will go with me?" No one answered the question, but after a period of silence one of the Yips said, "We know what is here on the top of this flat hill, and it seems to us a very pleasant place, but what is down below we do not know. The chances are it is not so pleasant, so we had best stay where we are." "It may be a far better country than this is," suggested the cookie cook. "Maybe, maybe," responded another Yip, "but why take chances? Contentment with one's lot is true wisdom. Perhaps in some other country there are better cookies than you cook, but as we have always eaten your cookies and like them except when they are burned on the bottom, we do not long for any better ones." Cake might have agreed to this argument had she not been so anxious to find her precious dishpan, but now she exclaimed impatiently, "You are cowards, all of you. If none of you are willing to explore with me the great world beyond this small hill, I will surely go alone." "That is a wise resolve," declared the Yips, much relieved. "It is your dishpan that is lost, not ours. And if you are willing to risk your life and liberty to regain it, no one can deny you the privilege." While they were thus conversing, the frogman joined them and looked down at the plain with his big eyes and seemed unusually thoughtful. In fact, the frogman was thinking that he'd like to see more of the world. Here in the Yip country he had become the most important creature of them all, and his importance was getting to be a little tame. It would be nice to have other people defer to him and ask his advice, and there seemed no reason so far as he could see why his fame should not spread throughout all Oz. He knew nothing of the rest of the world, but it was reasonable to believe that there were more people beyond the mountain where he now lived than there were Yips, and if he went among them he could surprise them with his display of wisdom and make them bow down to him as the Yips did. In other words, the frogman was ambitious to become still greater than he was, which was impossible if he always remained upon this mountain. He wanted others to see his gorgeous clothes and listen to his solemn sayings, and here was an excuse for him to get away from the Yip country. So he said to Cake the cookie cook, "I will go with you, my good woman," which greatly pleased Cake because she felt the frogman could be of much assistance to her in her search. But now, since the mighty frogman had decided to undertake the journey, several of the Yips who were young and daring at once made up their minds to go along, so the next morning after breakfast the frogman and Cake the cookie cook and 9 of the Yips started to slide down the side of the mountain. The bramble bushes and cactus plants were very prickly and uncomfortable to the touch, so the frogman quickly commanded the Yips to go first and break a path, so that when he followed them he would not tear his splendid clothes. Cake, too, was wearing her best dress and was likewise afraid of the thorns and prickers, so she kept behind the frogman. They made rather slow progress and night overtook them before they were halfway down the mountainside, so they found a cave in which they sought shelter until morning. Cake had brought along a basket full of her famous cookies, so they all had plenty to eat. On the second day the Yips began to wish they had not embarked on this adventure. They grumbled a good deal at having to cut away the thorns to make the path for the frogman and the cookie cook, for their own clothing suffered many tears, while Cake and the frogman traveled safely and in comfort. "If it is true that anyone came to our country to steal your diamond dishpan," said one of the Yips to Cake, "it must have been a bird, for no person in the form of a man, woman or child could have climbed through these bushes and back again." "And, allowing he could have done so," said another Yip, "the diamond-studded gold dishpan would not have repaid him for his troubles and his tribulations." "For my part," remarked a third Yip, "I would rather go back home and dig and polish some more diamonds and mine some more gold and make you another dishpan than be scratched from head to heel by these dreadful bushes. Even now, if my mother saw me, she would not know I am her son." Cake paid no heed to these mutterings, nor did the frogman. Although their journey was slow, it was being made easy for them by the Yips, so they had nothing to complain of and no desire to turn back. Quite near to the bottom of the great hill they came upon a great gulf, the sides of which were as smooth as glass. The gulf extended a long distance as far as they could see in either direction, and although it was not very wide, it was far too wide for the Yips to leap across it. And should they fall into it, it was likely they might never get out again. "Here our journey ends," said the Yips. "We must go back again." Kate the cookie cook began to weep. I shall never find my pretty dishpan again, and my heart will be broken. She sobbed. The frogman went to the edge of the gulf and with his eye carefully measured the distance to the other side.
Being a frog, said he, I can leap, as all frogs do, and being so big and strong, I am sure I can leap across this gulf with ease. But the rest of you, not being frogs, must return the way you came.
We will do that with pleasure, cried the yips, and at once they turned and began to climb up the steep mountain, feeling they had had quite enough of this unsatisfactory adventure. Cake the cookie cook did not go with them, however. She sat on a rock and wept and wailed and was very miserable.
Well, said the frogman to her, I will now bid you goodbye. If I find your diamond-decorated gold dishpan, I will promise to see that it is safely returned to you.
But I prefer to find it myself, she said.
See here, frogman, why can't you carry me across the gulf when you leap it? You are big and strong, while I am small and thin.
The frogman gravely thought over this suggestion. It was a fact that Kate the cookie cook was not a heavy person. Perhaps he could leap the gulf with her on his back.
If you are willing to risk a fall, said he, I will make the attempt.
At once she sprang up and grabbed him around his neck with both her arms. That is, she grabbed him where his neck ought to be, for the frogman had no neck at all. Then he squatted down, as frogs do when they leap, and with his powerful rear legs he made a tremendous jump. Over the gulf they sailed, with the cookie cook on his back, and he had leapt so hard to make sure of not falling in that he sailed over a lot of bramble bushes that grew on the other side and landed in a clear space which was so far beyond the gulf that when they looked back they could not see it at all.
Cake now got off the frogman's back and he stood erect again and carefully brushed the dust from his velvet coat and rearranged his white satin necktie.
I had no idea I could leap so far, he said wonderingly. Leaping is one more accomplishment I can now add to the long list of deeds I am able to perform.
You are certainly fine at leapfrog, said the cookie cook admiringly, but, as you say, you are wonderful in many ways. If we meet with any people down here, I am sure they will consider you the greatest and grandest of all living creatures.
Yes, he replied, I shall probably astonish strangers, because they have never before had the pleasure of seeing me. Also, they will marvel at my great learning. Every time I open my mouth, Cake, I am liable to say something important.
That is true, she agreed, and it is fortunate your mouth is so very wide and opens so far, for otherwise all the wisdom might not be able to get out of it.
Perhaps nature made it wide for that very reason, said the frogman. But come, let us now go on, for it is getting late and we must find some sort of shelter before night overtakes us.
Chapter 4. Among the Winkies. The settled parts of the Winkie country are full of happy and contented people who are ruled by a tin emperor named Nick Chopper, who in turn is a subject of the beautiful girl ruler, Ozma of Oz. But not all of the Winkie country is fully settled. At the east, which part lies nearest the Emerald City, there are beautiful farmhouses and roads, but as you travel west, you first come to a branch of the Winkie River, beyond which there is a rough country where few people live, and some of these are quite unknown to the rest of the world. After passing through this rude section of territory, which no one ever visits, you would come to still another branch of the Winkie River, after crossing which you would find another well-settled part of the Winkie country extending westward quite to the deadly desert that surrounds all the land of Oz and separates that favored fairyland from the more common outside world. The Winkies who live in this west section have many tin mines, from which metal they make a great deal of rich jewelry and other articles, all of which are highly esteemed in the land of Oz because tin is so bright and pretty and there is not so much of it as there is of gold and silver. Not all the Winkies are miners, however, for some till the fields and grow grains for food, and it was at one of these far west Winkie farms that the frogman and Cake the cookie cook first arrived after they had descended from the mountain of the yips.
Goodness me! Cried Nellery the Winkie wife when she saw the strange couple approaching her house. I have seen many queer creatures in the land of Oz, but none more queer than this giant frog who dresses like a man and walks on his hind legs. Come here, William, she called to her husband, who was eating his breakfast, and take a look at this astonishing freak.
William the Winkie came to the door and looked out. He was still standing in the doorway when the frogman approached and said with a haughty croak, Tell me, my good man, have you seen a diamond-studded gold dishpan?
No, nor have I seen a copper-plated lobster, replied William in an equally haughty tone.
The frogman stared at him and said, Do not be insolent, fellow.
No, added Cake the cookie cook hastily, you must be very polite to the great frogman, for he is the wisest creature in all the world.
Who says that? Inquired William.
He says so himself, replied Cake, and the frogman nodded and strutted up and down, twirling his gold-headed cane very gracefully.
Does the Scarecrow admit that this overgrown frog is the wisest creature in the world? Asked Willian.
I do not know who the Scarecrow is, answered Cake the Cookie Cook.
Well, he lives at the Emerald City, and he is supposed to have the finest brains in all Oz. The wizard gave them to him, you know.
Mine grew in my head, said the frogman pompously, so I think they must be better than any wizard brains. I am so wise that sometimes my wisdom makes my head ache. I know so much that often I have to forget part of it, since no one creature, however great, is able to contain so much knowledge.
It must be dreadful to be stuffed full of wisdom, remarked William reflectively and eyeing the frogman with a doubtful look. It is my good fortune to know very little.
I hope, however, you know where my jewel dishpan is, said the cookie cook anxiously.
I do not know even that, returned the Winky. We have trouble enough in keeping track of our own dishpans without meddling with the dishpans of strangers.
Finding him so ignorant, the frogman proposed that they walk on and seek Cake's dishpan elsewhere. William the Winky did not seem greatly impressed by the great frogman, which seemed to that personage as strange as it was disappointing. But others in this unknown land might prove more respectful.
I'd like to meet that Wizard of Oz, remarked Cake as they walked along a path. If he could give a scarecrow brains, he might be able to find my dishpan.
Poof! Grunted the frogman scornfully. I am greater than any wizard. Depend on me. If your dishpan is anywhere in the world, I am sure to find it.
If you do not, my heart will be broken, declared the cookie cook in a sorrowful voice. For a while the frogman walked on in silence. Then he asked, why do you attach so much importance to a dishpan?
It is the greatest treasure I possess, replied the woman. It belonged to my mother and to all my grandmothers since the beginning of time. It is, I believe, the very oldest thing in all the Yip country or was while it was there and, she added, dropping her voice to an odd whisper, it has magic powers.
In what way? Inquired the frogman, seeming to be surprised at this statement.
Whoever has owned the dishpan has been a good cook, for one thing. No one else is able to make such good cookies as I have cooked, as you and all the Yips know. Yet the very morning after my dishpan was stolen, I tried to make a batch of cookies and they burned up in the oven. I made another batch that proved too tough to eat, and I was so ashamed of them that I buried them in the ground. Even the third batch of cookies, which I brought with me in my basket, were pretty poor stuff and no better than any woman could make who does not own my diamond-studded gold dishpan. In fact, my good frogman, Cake the Cookie Cook will never be able to cook good cookies again until her magic dishpan is restored to her.
In that case, said the frogman with a sigh, I suppose we must manage to find it.
Chapter 5. Ozma's friends are perplexed.
Really, said Dorothy, looking solemn, this is very surprising. We can't even find a shadow of Ozma anywhere in the Emerald City, and wherever she's gone, she's taken her magic picture with her. She was standing in the courtyard of the palace with Betsy and Trot, while Scraps, the patchwork girl, danced around the group, her hair flying in the wind.
Perhaps, said Scraps, still dancing, someone has stolen Ozma.
Oh, they'd never dare do that. Exclaimed Tiny Trot.
And stolen the magic picture, too, so the thing can tell where she is, added the patchwork girl.
That's nonsense, said Dorothy.
Why, everyone loves Ozma. There isn't a person in the Land of Oz who would steal a single thing she owns.
Huh, replied the patchwork girl. You don't know every person in the Land of Oz.
Why don't I?
It's a big country, said Scraps. There are cracks and corners in it that even Ozma doesn't know of.
The patchwork girl's just affy, declared Betsy.
No, she's right about that, replied Dorothy thoughtfully. There are lots of queer people in this fairyland who never come near Ozma or the Emerald City. I've seen some of them myself, girls. But I haven't seen all, of course, and there might be some wicked persons left in Oz yet, though I think the wicked witches have all been destroyed.
Just then the wooden sawhorse dashed into the courtyard with the Wizard of Oz on his back.
Have you found Ozma? Cried the wizard when the sawhorse stopped beside them.
Not yet, said Dorothy. Doesn't Glinda the Good know where she is?
No. Glinda's book of records and all her magic instruments are gone. Someone must have stolen them.
Goodness me! Exclaimed Dorothy in alarm. This is the biggest steal I ever heard of. Who do you think did it, wizard?
I've no idea, he answered. But I have come to get my own bag of magic tools and carry them to Glinda. She is so much more